Had enough of the been there, done that ideas? Tired of too much talk and so little action? Rewind now and welcome to Transformation and Change Radio with Dr. Kathy Obair, where the vision of true equity, inclusion, courage, and purpose meet powerfully. Dr. Kathy delivers with dynamic, engaging conversation and the most authentically brave dialogue on air today. This hit show will challenge you to explore current issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion and deepen your capacity to choose courage to speak up to greater inclusion in everything you do. Fasten your seatbelts and accelerate your effectiveness to become a powerful change agent in your life, community, job, and society. Imagine true equity and inclusion and get the tools to really manifest your vision. No frills, no fluff, just really powerful, good stuff. Transformation and Change Radio starts now.
Just want to welcome everyone to this show. I am so excited to be talking about leading organizational change in these times. A candid conversation with my friend and colleague, Dr. Mwaba Gooden, Vice President for the Division of Diversity. I thought I saw inclusion and equity too, Kent State University.
Yeah.
So welcome to the
So happy to be here, Kathy.
I know, as I'm going to do a quick bio, I'm just, my heart is heavy. I could have led this almost every week over these last several years, if not decades. And heart heavy from the recent two mass murders of Asian Americans in California that I know of. Then a subsequent mass murder in Oakland that got very little, or at least I didn't see much. And then today, after a month of prosecution, the video of Tyre Nichols, the African-American man pulled over for a traffic stop. Mm-hmm. I know you know this. I'm talking to listeners. Mm-hmm. Really beaten close to death and then died 3 days later. And that's just the few that I read today. And so in these times, in addition to what's happening nationally, particularly in many states, the assault on K-12, higher ed, other organizations doing EDI, social racist justice work, I couldn't think of anybody else I wanted to have a series of conversations with. Dr. Mwaba Gooden, what I love so many things about you. One is, growing up in Jamaica and Canada, you bring so many intersecting perspectives. You did some work researching in Ghana and maybe other places that previous guests these 4 years haven't necessarily brought. And then did some of your first couple post-secondary degrees in Toronto, Canada, and then came to Temple to do more work on women's studies, African-American studies, which you got your doctorate in. Your depth of research, I just read one of your articles with some of your co-authors. Wait to read more. And your commitment to truly, it's in your bio, use higher education as the pathway to drive community mobilization and change for racialized and other underserved populations. And so what I'm struck with is that a researcher, publisher, professor, it seems to be a common pathway to senior diversity officer, where you now serve at Kent State University. Mm-hmm. And so I can't wait to just dive in. Insights, personal experiences, thoughts you see on the national level, because you also was one of the co-editors of NADAHI, the National Organization Diversity Officers in Higher Ed, the framework for advancing anti-racism strategy on campus. So as listeners, you're listening. Yes, we might be focused predominantly on higher ed in this session, and any and everything we do can translate to any other type of organization, I believe, as we've been doing. So, mobilizing for social justice. Welcome, and I can't wait to have a conversation.
So happy to be here, Kathy. Looking forward to the conversation.
I would love if you wouldn't mind starting off with just kind of a little bit more about yourself, how you personally are doing in these times.
Well, thank you. As you shared, my name is Mwaba Gooden. I use she, her pronouns. I identify as cisgendered, straight, middle class, Black woman, without any visible disability. And I offer my pronouns to stand in community with our trans brothers and sisters and members of our LGBTQ+ community. And then, of course, my identity, because it demonstrates where my privileges are, where my gaps are. But also I do that because I've done some really deep personal work and I encourage people to do that work as you take up social justice work. We really need to understand our positionality, how we show up in the world, for sure.
Mm. I'm still sitting with how you led with your privileged identities, which white people rarely do, much less folks who are experiencing such personal and group level oppression through racism, white supremacy. I'd love listeners to know a little bit more about any life experiences you have.
Yeah.
Wherever you're willing to share, knowing this is audio and visual video, and it'll be live out, so that they get a little context of how you came to be.
Yeah. Thank you for that question. I've been thinking about that more deeply for the last couple of years. I think we don't do enough of that work, really thinking about how our life experiences really create these foundational, right? The foundation of who we are. You know, I remember I was young, a little bit under 10, when I read Harriet Tubman, Moses of Her People. And that really stayed with me. It was the first time I was introduced to the history and the life experiences of African folks, even as a Black Jamaican Canadian. We didn't learn any of this in school. And I was really struck by Harriet's, her passion, her commitment to transform the United States through one single act at a time. And that really influenced me and stayed with me. I remember listening to reggae music that my parents played all the time and really learning about the world, you know, through lyrics by Bob Marley and Peter Tosh, Get Up, Stand Up for Your Rights. And I remember being in the basement at one particular moment and literally physically getting up because I knew that I wanted to be an individual who stood up to fill the gaps, but also who would stand up for social justice and for change. As a student at the University of Guelph in Southwestern Ontario, I was deeply influenced by a Professor Clarence Munford, but also by my fellow undergraduate student activist, you know, Nigtay Fula Medina, Charmaine Crawford, who are reading bell hooks, Angela Davis and Derek Bell, and really thinking about and listening to like Faith Nolan, who's a Canadian folks artist, and really being influenced by Winnie Mandela in South Africa during the anti-apartheid movement and joining some of that kind of grassroots organization in Canada as we really came to understand ourselves as citizens in Canada, but really as global citizens and really wanting to a change. We want to change for ourselves. But we understood that we stood on the shoulders of those who had gone before us. But we also were thinking in terms of the future for ourselves, but also just for the rest of the world. And those three things really influence how I show up, how I do my work. Those scholars and individuals still influence me greatly. Yeah, so a little bit of my history.
I'm reflecting on mine, as I guess the listeners are, and we are so different. It was many more decades before I had much of a call that I listened to for real social justice. I'm also struck, I listened to Heather McGee was interviewed by Dr. Beverly Tatum last night at Mount Holyoke College and several other colleges, Spelman and I think another. And she talked about, as a student asked, what can I do? How do I? And she said, if we could get more students to do just what you did, Mwabo, to find one area that you have passion about, get involved, community work, and learning to work collectively and collaboratively, and you don't have to be overwhelmed by it all, start here. And that one piece comes up in me because my guess is folks are feeling overwhelmed.
Yeah.
Oklahoma today is announcing, or maybe it was yesterday, that they're now asking every higher ed institution and maybe K-12, every dollar spent on equity, diversity, inclusion the last 10 years is what I read this morning, following what Florida's asking. So this culture of fear and the threat of the criminal F word. Well, it's a major criminal.
Okay.
For librarians to have books in their K-12 in Florida. Until I'm stirred because I can't find words. So in these times, what are some of the challenges in higher ed, K-12, other organizations, as we're working for a fair, equitable world, spatial, social justice challenges, and then maybe opportunities if you see them.
Yeah, and that fear is real, Kathy, and I don't want to dismiss it at all. You know, because there are times where you feel that you shouldn't have a reason to be fearful. I mean, individuals are fearful for their life. They're fearful for loss of employment, fearful of being surveilled, and that's real. So I encourage people to have conversations with colleagues who are doing this work in your place of employment, in your city, in your state, across the country, because that is real. But I also encourage individuals to look back and think about the civil rights movement and think about that, and even before that, right? You think about, if I'm going to use the experiences of Black folks around slavery and abolishment of slavery, how those of us who did this work, I'm thinking about individuals in the 60s and 70s doing feminist work or pushing for gender equality or fighting for LGBTQ plus issues, were always under surveillance. So it's nothing new in that sense. So I wonder what lessons, including myself, what lessons can we learn in terms of how they responded? And what I sit with is kind of community. Right? Community that then decides on collective action, because we're not in this on our own. And really doing social justice and anti-oppression work is a collective act. So thinking about the lessons we can learn, how can we use the energy of community to build our resolve, to care for us? How can we pause in those communities to build ourselves up as we decide to take this on? I do recommend also that if you are an individual who is isolated and you're the only person in that institution, that you find a community right now. It might not be in your institution, but it might be in your city, in their state, but find somebody who you can reach out to do this work. Because the only way to push back is going to be collective action.
I was talking to some senior diversity officers yesterday who are in a state where there's legislative attacks like the ones we've named. Mm-hmm. And we were wondering where people can go. So I love that you're offering build your own mm-hmm. network community. And it might be that underground people you know and trust come together, strategize, share below the radar. And I also wonder, it may not be a good strategy, but I wondered about some national organizations pulling together some national conversations or regional conversations about these times, how to support folks doing the work, especially in senior levels, but then strategies to work with these times with the legislative organizational dynamics. Don't know if you have any thoughts on that, because as a white person, I get into we have to, and it may not be safe.
Yeah. So there are some national organizations bringing, you know, diversity officers together, higher ed. I'm thinking of American Public and Land Grant Universities now has a diversity DEI council, if you will, that is really having these conversations. The National Association of Diversity Officers in Higher Education, NADAHI, has both their national meeting, but they also have chapters where they actually invite all across the nation, invite those diversity offers into those spaces to have those conversations. I know NCORE is beginning to offer webinars around some of this. Those are helpful. But we also have some national non-higher ed organizations. I'm thinking about the National Diversity Council. So there are these organizations I think people can reach out to. But I really like what we're talking about the need sometimes to identify, you know, where we need to go, because it might not be these national organizations. It might just be that we need to create a site or a space for ourselves to come together to have that. And, you know, I welcome people to reach out to me at my email. It's amwabagooden@me.com if they want to strategize around the kinds of support that they need.
Because in these times, the emotional support with exhaustion of folks in any kind of equity, diversity role, especially anti-racist, social justice in ways, the culture of fear, the real chance for livelihood, if not physical doxing, I could keep going.
Yeah.
And so the space for folks to come together, possibly across racial identity, doing this work as well as parallel work. Do you have any other hopes and thoughts as folks are doing, you know, diversity, equity folk? What's the type of together and parallel work by race? Because it is a breadth of differences. The race in this country seems to be where the violent reaction is.
I love the fact that you brought up working across difference, because it's really important. I was just reading this week, the American Council on Education has a shared equity leadership article that they put out a couple months ago. And it really reminded me of bell hooks's From Margin to Center framework that really doesn't ask those on the margins, those with marginalized and minoritized identity, to walk to the center. It's asking people, those who reside at the center with privilege, to go to the margins, actually to work with individuals who are minoritized, who are underserved, who are racialized, or who have or historically marginalized, to work with individuals. That's where the expertise lies, right? That's where the knowledge resides. So it's imperative that we actually work across difference. There's also the expectation, Kathy, I think, for those of us with marginalized identity to want to live at the center. And I think we need to push back against that a little bit, right? Because if we think about the center as power and privilege, why would we want to live there and reside there? And so to think about recreating the landscape of higher education, where leaders are actually working with multiple people to develop a model of shared equity, a model of change, so that it's a collaborative process and not an individual process.
Okay, you could see by my face, I was like, what? Because again, in all my privileged identities, I'm like opening doors, sponsoring, let's shift hiring practices so we get folks with racial consciousness, competence, identity in positions of power to also help change. So could you say more about what you envision are possible other models, and especially if you have small pockets where things are happening? This is what brings me hope. I don't know if listeners are excited about these possibilities yet.
Yeah, so I'm not saying that those of us with marginalized identity should not all reside, work at that center. We totally have to do that. Mm. What I'm asking us to do is think about how we think about how we move and collaborate in institutions to bring about change. So history has told us that our colonial model and structures have not changed. We have experts, so we can take Angela Davis, who's been doing this work, or Beverly Guy Sheftall for years, bell hooks, and what has changed in the academy. So what I'm offering is that we think about how we do this work differently, so we can sustain ourselves, so we can thrive, and so that we can actually live, so that we are moving, right, individuals who have power and privilege to the margins, to work with those in the margins, because that's where the power and expertise lies. And even though we're placing individuals in the center, those individuals such as myself or you are still, we live also at the margins, even though we might work in the center, right? So we're going back and forth. So I'm asking leaders to reframe how they think, how they organize, who they bring to the table, who are the experts, and who they're honoring, whose voice they're honoring in the process.
Really flipping who are the experts, when particularly in the academy, whites, you had male, cisgender, upper class, middle, upper middle, have been taught, I know I was taught, you're the expert, your value is your competence, how much you do, your work is your life. Mm-hmm. And so what specifically would that look like? Because right now, many campuses and organizations would have diversity councils, equity councils that might be seated by the leadership group and maybe meet occasionally, but they're often parallel. They're affinity spaces or business ERGs, employee resource groups. So what other models could, if leaders are listening or people want to manage up, what are other ways to have leaders move and work to the margins and really center the expertise and competence of those who've been working?
So I'm thinking about some of the sessions you offer on, identity and positionality, right? So I think it really begins with the self-work, really thinking about how you're positioned, what your privileges are, how your identities or how you identify, how that ties into the power structure. So doing some of that personal work as kind of a first step, if you will. And this is if you certainly for everybody, but especially for those who are white doing this work, really doing that work. And so what it might look like is if I'm thinking about the Diversity Council, whose voice sits on the Diversity Council? How are they compensated for their extra service in the organization? How are their voices valued when they're making a contribution? And are they identified in doing this work on a regular basis across the university? So that, you know, this is also professional development also for some of our staff and faculty participating in that process in changing the landscape of what the university looks like. And of course, you know, who gets hired? You know, to do this work? And is it, are you only hiring those with marginalized identity to serve as DEI individuals? Or do they have other positions like chief of staff or president or CEOs, you know, financial officers? So how people are placed in the organizations is also really important because it brings a diversity of voice. So for me, it would be who are you hiring? Are they doing that individual personal work with individuals? And how are they bringing the voices of those that are marginalized to the table so they're valued and individuals could see that their voices matter in transformational change?
Mm-hmm. And so it's not just a few who get appointed these committees. There's a cross-section or a community change process where there's lots of voice, there's lots of input beyond an annual survey, a few focus groups. There's yeah. some type of mobilizing, get involved, ongoing transformational change.
Yeah. And really pushing back against this idea of an individual as, I'm going to say, the hero, right? So some of my research looks at leadership and collective action. And really in Western thought, we overvalue the individual as a leader, as a sole entity of change. When in fact, if we look at MLK, I mean, his path to leadership came out of collective action of the community, primarily women. So really rethink about how we identify leader, both individually, but leader as a collective action or as collective leaders, I think is really important for transformational change.
And the whitewashing of Dr. King to these, you know, few quotes that I see a lot of white colleagues post this month. And I'm reminded every year about he was against militarization and war and economic injustice and poverty in addition to racism.
Yeah, really quite radical, right, in his later days. Yeah, but we have whitewashed and sanitized him, so he's palatable to the white imagination.
And to your point, you got me thinking, having him be the hero. So theoretically, once he was assassinated, assuming that the work. And so as you think about ways you've seen, done, people are talking about, how do we create more sustainable, transformative social justice, racial justice in these times? Mm-hmm. When I'm seeing, and I'm hearing some colleagues say, top leaders have pulled back from their commitment to what they said in those letters after George Floyd was murdered 2.5 years ago, that may not be what you're seeing. But in these times, in the national context, international context, what are possible ways to keep the work moving forward in a sustainable way, organizationally and personally and collectively?
Yeah, that's just a great question. You know, what I'm seeing across the nation is that some of the leaders of our institutions are fearful, right, because of legislative action. And also, certainly the last year, the focus on critical race theory, right, and the impact it's had at the state and city level, for sure, loss of funding is a huge concern for leaders. You know, one of the things I think will be helpful to leaders is really to think about what we're talking about, collective action. You know, really resisting this idea that only one individual could do this work. I think it's so important. So I think coming together, identifying what the challenges are, whether it's institutional level, the city level, the state level, and then working nationally to address this. We know from American history that only through collective action that change occurs, and that's something that we cannot and should not lose sight of. I understand that as university leaders, the framework in which you work doesn't lend itself to collective action. But we know all university presidents, for example, meet across the state in a collective group. Can that body, right? Be diversified and then offer a challenge to state legislature. Can that body use the voice of the staff, faculty, and students to advance change? Students are a powerful source in this. We know this. We've got at Kent State, we have the Black United Students who, you might not know this, but it was really the first organization to formalize Black History Month at the higher ed level. So celebrated it for a month, documented in 1970. There's so much power in student population because they're not tied to an economic infrastructure. But I think thinking about how our students are a powerful voice and change is going to be really important, I think, for higher ed in general.
Totally agree. And you're thinking about the president's organizing. The same conversation with senior Dorsey officers, I wondered if we had lessons from post-Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't know how many parallels there are.
Yeah.
History major, and I've learned a bit more. And one of the senior Dorsey officers said, you know, one way between then and through the 50s, 60s was to have whites, so folk of color and whites organizing, folks of color and leadership expertise, and then saying, white folks, you be the face here, or you go talk to this person. And so I'm wondering about how many presidents, vice presidents are white and or have other privileged identities, and see our role as you said, let's get the voices, our deeper understanding, and then how do we use our positionality and privilege to then lead with other systemic change and take the hits, because presidents, VPs, provosts, there's far less risk.
Yeah, that's right. And it actually, you had asked about what I thought about affinity work earlier, and I didn't address it. So you're right. This is an opportunity for those who are identify with a particular identity to do this work as a group, but also think strategically about, as you're saying, how they can use their privileges, both as allies and also, as Bettina Love says, co-conspirator, right? Individuals who are going to use their privilege to push back, to take the hit if needed, and to create a safe buffer for those who look like us, right? Doing this work with marginalized identity.
So some listeners with marginalized identities might be saying, this all sounds nice, but I don't have folks in higher. Mm-hmm. So you're about to go to break. Some, be thinking about as we come back, maybe some strategies to develop relationships with folks with different positional power, whether mm-hmm. it's by identity and or hierarchical position, ways to build relationships among different groups that are already doing work, either leadership groups and or EDI. And mm-hmm. instead of separate, parallel working together, whether it's through training and then planning, strategizing beyond mm-hmm. writing a strategic plan and checking it off.
Yeah.
I think we just have a couple minutes. Did that spur anything?
Yeah, it did, for example. And I'm very conscious of the fact that not all diversity officers have an ally or co-conspirator in their spaces. I'm actually, just saying that makes me nervous, right? And I can't imagine the space that an individual who does not have that buffer lives in and what they face. Yeah. As it goes back to our earlier point about finding one individual that they can rely on, if not in the organization, outside of the organization, so they can strategize, because there's no way that an individual can actually face that and address all that those issues on their own. So they might have to find affinity groups outside of their organizations and learn how to strategize and bring back some of those skills to the organization. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And maybe one other person on the president's leadership.
Yeah.
And or within the provost leadership, depending where they're sitting, that has a voice, is listened to, and needs more development, but then they're willing to listen to expertise and partner.
Yeah.
I can't wait to come back from break, Dr. Mwaba Goodman. Could you please say your email again and how people can find you if they want to do follow-up conversations, bring you to their organizations for coaching, consulting, training?
Sure. It's mwabagooden@me.com. mwabagooden@me.com.
Thank you so much. And I'm Dr. Kathy Aubert, Center for Transformation and Change. And again, on the website, you'll see access to some open resources, my Leading White Accountability Groups, Navigating Difficult Situations course, and others. And my website, drkathyaubert.com. Even more resources there. All my books are free. And so just breathe as you're listening. Long-term systemic change, 7, 10, 12 years, and that's if everything else is going. In these times, there's crises, it seems like, every week that's impacting the people we work with and serve. So just keep breathing. When we come back from break, we'll keep digging deeper with Dr. Mwamba Gooden.
Are you passionate about impacting social change or working towards anti-racism as a society? Are you willing to deconstruct your innermost thoughts, ideas, and beliefs about racism? Then Inflection Point Podcast, Cultivating Change from the Inside Out, is the show for you. Join Anita Russell, Mavis Bauman, and Gail Hunter in open, honest, and deliberate conversations every first and third Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, only on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Are you ready to put down that drink or drug for good? Are you struggling to maintain your recovery from addictive behaviors? Do you need help with a family member or loved one who's in early recovery or battling addiction? Get the help and guidance you need by arranging a recovery recharged phone session with me, Ellen Stewart, Pushy Broad from the Bronx, certified life and recovery coach. Call 1-800-889-1757. Make an appointment today. Or go to my website, pushybroadfromthebronx.com, and click on the link that says Recovery Recharged. Don't wait. Get the help you need today. This is Ellen Stewart, Pushy Broad from the Bronx, on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
When the solutions to the challenges in your life are unclear, an executive business coach may be the answer. I'm Mark Fechner, and I specialize in coaching clients with issues related to performance, leadership, business relationships, and creativity. Any person or organization that wants to overcome mental blocks, create new possibilities, and achieve a higher level of performance can benefit from the services of a certified coach. Schedule a free consultation with me today at markfechner.com.
Are you looking for a way to break old habits that are holding you back from reaching your true potential and living the life you deserve? Well, look no further than Dr. Loretta Billups. She is a clinician and a relationship and mental health coach that will assist you with reaching your purpose. She will hold you accountable so that your desires are now a reality. Connect with Dr. B at cultivatingyourlife.com and find your path today. That's cultivatingyourlife.com.
Welcome back. I'm Dr. Kathy Aubert, Center for Transformation Change Radio. Can't wait. Dr. Mwamba Gooden, Vice President for Division of Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, Kent State University. We kind of left off talking and we wanted to talk more about how do we support folks doing equity work in organizations, particularly if they're in more mid to senior level equity officers, senior equity, diversity officers in these times. And I didn't know if you had other thoughts about what could be needed there.
You know, and that I must say that I'm so glad that we're talking about this. And I'm thinking about a couple of individuals that I've spoken to that are in these positions that are feeling really isolated. And my one immediate piece of advice is self-care. Identify how you can take care of yourself, both personally and professionally, because the institutions will always be there. So you want to make sure that when you exit the institution, you're exiting as a whole individual who is healthy. So that's my first advice. The second advice is to try, if you can, if it's impossible to build relationship within your unit, and which I know might be possible, try and find an ally outside of your unit. That ally might look like you, but it might be somebody that's different. And it's important to find find your ally, because that person's going to offer you some solace, some source of strength, but also might have a knowledge and history of the institution that you might not have. They might also have networks and friends in other places that you might be able to connect with. And then I want to think you to think about who in senior leadership have relationships with, who you can build relationships with, so that you know that you have an advocate for you when you are not in a particular room. And now this might take some time. It might mean that you have a mentor outside the institution that you're talking to about how you can strategize and do some of these things. Again, if you want to reach out to me, Amwaba Gooden at me.com, I'm willing to have a conversation with anybody, Kathy, because I'm talking to the audience, with anybody, about how they might strategize to do some of these things. I also will ask individuals to attend some functions. It might be an event or an affinity group that you can join. If you're not a member of the affinity group, maybe there are functions that you can go to that you can build those relationships with individuals that might have the same passion around social justice as you do.
And building off of that last point, the idea of building relationships with folks in more positionality, power, relationships to people with power, the thought of saying, there's a speaker in a week, why don't we catch a quick dinner and go together? Yeah. And so it's the breaking bread together, being so just be able to sit with folk. Now, again, that takes long. It also takes energy, which what is that? I'm reminded how the story is Mahatma Gandhi. In India, build a relationship with the daughter of the governor, colonial imperialist governor from Britain. And through that building relationship, then she worked with the governor, her father. So that's what I remember about the story. I just always remind myself that it's, as you said, through community and coming together and brainstorming. So let's say a senior diversity officer or director of a multicultural center had one ally. Talk with them about, well, who are the potential allies and how can we collectively, or whole equity team brainstorming, who is almost ready to be a sponsor, mentor, ally, and then who can work with them so that we, it's those good organizing principles that were civil rights in the 60s before that, that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. The other thing that comes to mind, I'm sorry, were you coming in?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking as you were talking, Kathy, is that there is, you know, there's a contradiction in doing this work. Those of us who do this work in institutions are often hired to respond to the urgency. I'm thinking of MLK's urgency of now. But the reality is, to do this work takes time. You have to build relationships and you have to be able to trust. So it's sometimes contradictory, you know, based on our job description expectation, but what the reality really is.
How organization change really happens.
Yeah.
It's so slow. It's even slower than turtles. You also have me think about the many organizations have an equity group, a team that does. It might be a group of two, or it might be a couple here and a couple in HR, and maybe partnering with an equity diversity council to really come together, not only for that community care, but to scan and do a power analysis of the organization, the region, as you said, maybe nationally, to see, I don't know, they call it SWOT, but what are the strengths, weaknesses, threats, opportunities? And there's probably even a better model. But to have folks feel in community while they're analyzing, talk about their personal fears, what their family is feeling, if they have friends, but to have a community where in a sacred, confidential space, and also strategizing. So really learn from community organizing for centuries, and how do we bring that into equity work in formal organizations like a college, university? I don't know what you think.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great idea. I'm thinking about, I recently traveled to another state and had a wonderful meeting with a number of women who was, they were doing this work, not all in higher education, but personally, just for me, having that dinner was so rewarding. As I listened to their challenges, I was able to offer opportunities to think about, and they did the same thing for me, but it was so rewarding. One, I didn't feel like I was so isolated and alone, but I was building community with individuals who had been doing this work for such a long time. And that was really, really important for my well-being as well as my professional development.
Well-being, professional development, and opening up strategies for change, when we can share, it's not just me, because my fear is the pressure that individuals like you feel. I have to do it by myself because the system wants you doing it. And when you don't call back, text, president's calls, I'm not saying you personally, then the retribution that happens if you don't cater to the demands of the cabinet members, everybody in the provost office who looked at you as the hero, the savior, the MLK. That might not have been a good analogy.
No, it's perfect, because I think we all are called, I think, in positions like this to be the hero, to show up as the soul, right? Solution person, the person providing the solution. And in fact, most of us have to check our ego at the door, right? And really think about, what does that mean for my ego if I'm going to be the savior of this institution? Is that the best way to go forward and to be of service, not only to the institution, to yourself, but also to your community? And the way I look at it, Kathy, is everybody on Kent State's campus where I work should actually step in and do this work. Because after I'm gone, I'm hoping that there is a legacy, but also capacity, individual, organizational, for other people to step in and do this work. But the system, as you're saying, pushes one individual, the expert, one individual, the provider, right? The responder to all of these things.
I don't know if that's that glass cliff analogy somebody mentioned in one of the shows earlier. And as soon as you, we don't give you the resources or support, do it for us, do everything we tell you to do. But as soon as it's not working, you get pushed off a glass cliff.
Yeah. This idea that, and that gets back to your question about individuals who are doing this work on its own. This is a really great opportunity for leadership to think, well, can one individual do this work on their own, and how do they need to be supported? And are we actually building this glass cliff that we're going to either push them off, or they're going to fall off because they have not been provided the support to actually do this work? Yeah.
Throughout this radio show, we've talked about the critical need for leaders to create clear competencies they will require, hire to, hold people accountable, and that they will then in their organizations be responsible for, as well as collectively overall. What I'd like to talk about a bit more is, since George Floyd was murdered, I think so many senior leaders are getting much more pressure to not do this equity work, especially racial justice. And so I didn't know if you could talk about maybe some of those pressures and the dilemmas that leaders are in. And then we might get to some creative ways that some are working within those. And maybe it is under the radar.
And thank you for actually asking that question, because that pressure is real. I mean, and that pressure is threatening to deny funding. Funding based on, as we know, what's in front of the Supreme Court right now, race-based admission, right? And that's a real threat. So leaders do have to respond and think critically about what that means to their institution. And again, I think I always go back, well, what can we learn from future, from past grassroots movements? What can we learn from the feminist movement, from the civil rights movement? And one of the things I've learned, and Malcolm X said this, by any means necessary. Now, people actually imagine that meant violence, but it really, really wasn't around that. It was about, what do you need to do at that one moment to have a particular end? And for us, if it's social justice, what can we do, right, to be responsive, recognize a threat is happening, but to be forward thinking? And I don't have any solutions besides offering, again, collective action. Coming together with a number of people who are experienced learning from national organizations, from local organizations, about how we can actually respond to this threat. I'm thinking about some of the, anti-gender affirming care that's in our national legislature, and what we've learned from how people have responded, which is to go to the legislature to protest, but also to put experts on the panel. So I think there are different ways that we can actually approach this, for sure. I know some leaders across the nation are thinking about race-based admission and thinking about how they're advertising and marketing, right, and recruiting students and thinking maybe around social class. We know race and class are mirror images of each other. Thinking about first-gen students, and we know those who are Pell eligible are those who are also historically marginalized, and really thinking about the language they're using in marketing as a response to what's happening nationally. But they're coming to that decision based on conversations with leaders across the nation.
And so if folks are listening, who's even in your city, your region, or even your organization? So it's not just a president and cabinet member, senior diversity officer, but other folks doing key equity work. Come together, talk about what's really going on and what could be some strategies. Because my wonder is folks below the cabinet level may not appreciate how donors are pulling million, $5 million grants, how your board is threatening to fire the president. And if people watch the news, you know, higher ed news, so last year, you'll probably see a good bit of these themes. And so in addition to the legislators, so to have this collective group come together and understand all of the threats and not just what they see from their positionality, and then do some strategizing.
You know, I really like you reinforcing the fact that leaders don't need to only rely on leaders to be a part of that collective group, that they have to, again, walk to the margins, right? Use different people and different levels of expertise to come up with a solution and a response.
To your point, I'm thinking directors of the different equity centers, and maybe within that, the folks that are doing the student development as well as training, folks that are doing EDI training in the different pockets, whether it's an academic, whether it's an HR and training development, the folks that are doing hiring, staff, faculty, leader. So those are all just pockets. And then there are just so many generic pockets of EDI work that have just come up. Many faculty have centers and those sorts of things. And so collectively thinking about how do we keep, okay, I just paused because if people record these conversations and put them out, then other organizations might find out what you're doing. So I just want to be clear that these aren't safe spaces. Mm-hmm. And yet to be able to say, how do we, student success, full breadth of differences within this context, how do we keep doing what we're doing? How do we continue to hire people with the cultural competence we need to do this work? How do we keep hiring and retaining and letting? So having those conversations locally and nationally, I was just saying to someone this week, can we talk about it as equity inclusion, serving the full breadth of our students, staff and faculty, retention? So some of those, as you were saying, without saying people of color, race, racism, white supremacy, culture, and my body just went, and I hope I'm practical enough. I've been willing to do workshops where literally the people said, you can't say oppression, you can't say racism. Mm-hmm. I said, well, what can I say that gets to the same outcome? And then I say, here's the work we're doing about dismantling policies, practices, climate, culture, microaggressions. Oh, you can't say microaggressions. So I can say daily indignities, unproductive behaviors. Yes. Mm-hmm. So I was willing to negotiate some terminology. Can't say anti-Blackness. So long as we're talking about transformative change at the individual, group, and organizational level.
Yeah. That's difficult, right? Yeah. And I do think for those of us doing this work, we do need to take a pause and think about whether this is a space that actually continue to exist in, right? Based on how we think about our own authenticity, about how we want to do the work. But I'm going to go back to the civil rights movement and Malcolm X, by any means necessary to advance social justice and change. And there are times where we are going to have to compromise. But, you know, I'm also of the mind that, and, you know, maybe the listeners are not going to agree with me. I don't know if you'll agree with me either. I'm not in this to change people's hearts and minds. I'm in this to transform our practices or policies or procedures and our processes. Okay. Everybody has equal opportunity. Everybody has equity and access, and they actually can feel included and they have a sense of belonging. Yeah. And also, and maybe at the end, people will be able to see the world through the lens of some others, right? And can maybe empathize in terms of how individuals show up. I read earlier this week, and it was one particular white male leader who was asked to lead an EDI effort. And he really talked about his struggles with it. And his struggle stopped when he paused and began to think about his own history, his own positionality, his own privilege. And he built deep relationships with people who were different from him. And he began to care about them. And when he began to care about them, that's when he was able to really begin to work with communities to really impact change.
And move to the margins and be with people, as you're saying, and then use his privilege. Because many organizations are not ready for someone like you or other folk of color, even some white activists, to be working in EDI offices. They're just not ready developmentally. They're still down here in the growth, and they're not up here yet. We've talked about that in some other shows. And so strategically, what's necessary given the climate you're in?
Yeah. And I also want to offer this, because there's really no race to innocence in a lot of ways. I want to offer that for those with marginalized identities who are minoritized, that our work is about our own privileges, but also the way in which we've internalized kind of a colonial white supremacist way of thinking. So even as we're doing this work, we're also unlearning, right? So, and that makes the work difficult. So it's so important that we're actually caring for ourselves, even as we're doing this work and caring for others.
And that brave, safe, confidential space for folk in the affinity, marginalized identity is where I believe so much of that healing work is so deserved, supported by institutions, unless people would be punished and outed if they do it. And so people who are listening, they can help create those. And I believe parallel spaces, we said, for folks in privileged groups, how we perpetuate colluded colonial, imperialist, white supremacy. Did I get all the words you used?
Yeah. Although I'm not sure if I used all of them, but yes, I'll take them.
So just breathe, listeners. I wasn't able to use those words until after I got challenged to dig more after George Floyd was murdered to see what I was missing in my work.
Whew. And I'm going to offer this because I think oftentimes when people hear those terms, it's weaponized at the individual level sometimes, right? But really when the terms are offered, it's thinking about systems of oppression that support a particular way of being. We can think about the recent killing, right, of Tyre Nichols as an example. So all of us, there's really no race to innocence, and all of us are implicated and need to step in to advance change.
I think you've really hit on something that's been a theme of how people in our privileged identities, often white, take it personally if we say something that we get confronted about or we're asked to do something different. And it's like, oh, I'm not a good person. I'm a bad person. And so hearing these terms about a colonial mindset, I love how you're saying, actually, it's a mindset we've all absorbed, white supremacist mindset. And again, not saying everyone's white supremacist as in those that have joined these groups and publicly say, I'm a member of these groups. It's the culture, the way of being, centering white culture is the only right way to be, and the oppression that's built in to systems for centuries that we're still perpetuating in our silence and naivete and ignorance. White accountability groups can be wonderful interventions in your organizations, having leaders come together with other white folk across the organization to do that self-work. And to be honest, an organization I was brainstorming with, and they were doing it now by gender. So I've done some white women and folks that were socialized as white girls work. So we'll do that. And then I said, you know, people socialized as white men with white privilege, however they identify today, I could help facilitate that group in my kind of arrogance. And so we're going to try it. Deep healing work.
That's great. So I have a question to ask. So I read actually a couple weeks ago that there is a fear around talking about whiteness because it will give it more currency, if you will. It will legitimize it in a way and make it important in a way that we shouldn't recognize. I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
And then can I ask you?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
My tendency is to talk about the elephant in the room, the water we're swimming in, whatever metaphor. And so I can appreciate, especially if this fear is coming, well, wherever it's coming from, the margins or the center. But I think in my privileged identities, until I really could talk about what classism looked like, where it's showing up in me, whiteness, how whiteness is showing up in me, racist attitudes, behaviors that I have done, could still do. It's almost like those 12-step models. The first step is admitting step one. And so I lean towards, but if a lot of folk of color, even some folk of color, disagree, then I would want to rethink this. But I'd be, what I do with organizations, I talk about how whiteness shows up in the culture and the climate and individual interactions, policies, practices, so mm-hmm. that we can recognize it and interrupt it. And then in our planning, get rid of some of the whiteness, even as we're planning a new project. So I'm curious what you think.
Yeah, no, I agree with you completely. I do think we have to have conversations about whiteness, as Sarah said, whiteness is currency, right? How it's actually normalized. Because unless we have the conversation, it does remain invisible in a way. And we don't understand and won't understand how it's actually operationalized. So I think it's imperative and important that we continue to have the conversations, just as we do around Blackness or indigeneity or gender, right?
I think we have a topic for our next conversation, because you've agreed to go back. We have a few minutes left. Is it okay if I... Because hearing Heather McGee, and if people don't know her book, The Sum of Us, Heather McGee, The Sum of Us, go get it, read it, and or if you're an auditory learner, you can get it on there, or there are many podcasts. She actually has a full podcast this year, but Chris Hayes and Ezra Klein, I know I listened to those a year and a half ago or so. She really, one of her central things, I think she talks about, is the solidarity dividend. And this idea, as you were talking about a moment ago, it's in all of our best interests to dismantle any policy, practice, norm, way of being that actually does not open up to the full humanity and thriving of all. And that might be what we talk a bit more about next time, but I didn't know if you had any thoughts about how do we support folks in their privileged identities to begin to recognize the solidarity dividend that in the South, they close. Actually, I think Cheverly, Maryland, I think they might have changed our pool when they were integrating pools. 2000, I think, across the nation were closed or filled in with cement. So the entire community no longer had public pools. So that metaphor of filling in the pool. So how do we help people in their privileged identities realize it's in everyone in their best interest to do equity change work?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I have to read Heather McGee's book. I'm thinking, you know, of the work that we do on identity when we're doing work on bias, microaggressions, and race, and using the people's lived experience of how solidarity benefits them. It might be a church community, if you will. It might be a nonprofit that they work with, that they actually get benefits from working collectively with people who look like them. And so I don't know how Heather uses solidarity dividend. I'm imagining it's about the social capital that people receive from the groups that they're in. But I also think if we go back to the example of the individual I was speaking about when he shared that it was only in doing positionality work on his identity and building relationships with people who didn't look like him, and he began to care about them, that's when he could actually do that work. So what I would say about that is that individuals, in terms of kind of thinking about white folks who don't understand the need of working across difference, is to provide examples, right? Or think about their own lives, right? And in terms of what they've received from working in organizations or groups. I don't know if I've answered your question.
You brought in a whole, your focus on collaboration, collectiveness. Listeners are going, Kathy, you don't do that often. This is, I'm kind of immersed in whiteness. What I think we'll do a bit more next time as we continue this conversation is, how are whites hurt by racism? So I think that's the solidary dividend, is in that those communities, the white folks no longer had public pools. I'm thinking about, I'm going to find out which county in Virginia closed all of public schools when they were going to integrate for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And it hurt not all white children, because my parents in Maryland sent me to a private high school. So it's that concept of, how are people in our privileged identities, how are men hurt by sexism? Don't experience it, but how does patriarchy hurt men? How does this? So that's,
yes, I see,
kind of where I want to go. I'm sure we're building on Heather McGee's work, but to get leaders, the personal relationship and the opening the heart is one way. Another way is for them to realize that their life is narrowed and hurt because of the way hiring is happening, the way performance management is happening. And it's not because it's hurting marginalized folks, it's hurting to be in a toxic work environment, which is often hyper masculine whiteness, right? Hurts all people, even if they're getting class privilege, male privilege, white privilege in the process. So that's kind of, you can tell I'm kind of hyper about wanting to talk to you about that.
I'm looking forward to reading Heather's work and then to continue this conversation for sure.
And I'll bring in some work, Paul Kibble, How Whites Are Hurt by Racism. And so I'll do some thinking, because as folks are listening, it really is, I think, the middle managers and top leaders of any organizations that are the cement. And until we can soften that and get them moving, whether through personal relationship, collective conversation, action, what's in it for them, then we're going to be here facing all this opposition and exhausted until we get folks in positional leadership working with the folks at the margin, as you've said. And I'm not seeing much of that these days. So,
yeah. Okay. Looking forward to that conversation.
As we close, we just have a couple minutes. Any other things you're working on? Any other writing you're doing? Projects you're excited about, or other advice for leaders and listeners?
Yeah, I'm actually really working on putting together a piece on using bell hooks framework from margin to center, and really kind of creating a framework that leaders can utilize in terms of advancing change in their organization. I'm looking forward to reading Heather McGee's work, though, to see also what I can actually learn from that to include it in some of what I do.
Well, I can't wait to write about this, having folks in the positional power in the centers moving out and partnering, and not that top-down, let's help, patronizing. Yeah. It's actually, we have to work together. So how can we use our different knowledge, experience, wisdom, positionality, power, influence?
Yeah.
But it does go.
I'm telling you, if people on the margins have survived all this time, we've got a lot to learn from those of us living on the margins.
Hmm. We'll let listeners breathe that in as we close. Could you let people again know if they want to contact you, have you come to the organization virtually or in person?
Sure. Amwaba Gooden at meetme.com, AmwabaGooden at meetme.com. And you could also reach me through Kathy, for sure.
Thank you. I forgot to say that. Y'all have my information. If not, you can just Google me. And Amwaba, thank you. I hope folks got as much out of this as I did. And I can't wait to continue talking about solidarity dividend, what's in it for people and privileged identities, and the currency of whiteness. We'll come back to that next month. I wish you all the best from Center for Transformation Change Radio. Take care of yourself and take care with others in these times. Take care.
You've been listening to Dr. Kathy O'Bear on Transformation Talk Radio. Thanks for tuning in, and be sure to catch us next time as Kathy inspires listeners to become agents of change, motivate, innovate, and speak truth to power. Step into the courageous you that will change the world. Connect to life-changing conversations to extend your reach. For more information on Kathy and her work, please visit drkathyobear.com. That's drkathyobear.com.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers. and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.